It was incredibly bohemian, incredibly fun. I was part of the Sidewalk Chalk Artist Guild, and it was a kind of ragtag. I mean, almost imagine like artist pirates is the best way I could describe it.
You're a passionate creative, and so are we. Join me, Bree Stockwell, and my podcast partner, Len Metcalf, as we navigate the ups and downs of living creative lives while teaching you how to do it too. Time to pull back the curtain on our creative affair. Hey everyone, welcome back to Creative Affair. I'm Bree and I'm here with Len. And today we have a really beautiful, lovely guest named Gabrielle, and she is now Gabrielle Wildheart, which I love so much. So welcome, by the way, to our little affair.
Thank you.
Would you just start by telling us a little bit about like who you are, what you do, a little bit about your background? It would be lovely.
Sure thing. It's a pleasure to be here. And yes, my name is Gabrielle Wildheart, and I am a painter and public artist. And I got my start in my art career when I was 20 years old and moved to Italy thinking I was going to do a 6-month portrait painting apprenticeship. And while there, I discovered the art of sidewalk chalk street busking. And I became obsessed with creating big paintings on the ground in temporary chalk pastel. And that 6-month trip turned into 3 years of living in Europe and completely altered my art career. And I went from thinking I was going to be a traditional portrait artist to becoming very passionate about doing big pieces and public pieces. And that has ended up being what I have done for my career. So I do a lot of murals on the sides of buildings. I work with schools and businesses, cities to bring public art to urban spaces and enliven communities. And I also have my own studio practice, which is very dear to my heart and it forms a part of my career. And like many artists, I have lots of different income streams and threads of things that I'm working on. I teach sometimes. I do some mixed media. I have my public artwork. I'm starting a podcast as well. So I just am excited to be here and talk about living that creative life. It's something that I know very intimately.
It's so wonderful to have you on our show, and it's so exciting to talk to you. And what a lovely story of starting off going one way and then finding something else and then it taking over for from a 6-month trip to a 3-year trip working on the sidewalk. So imagine that was quite an incredible experience. And what was that like?
It was incredibly bohemian, incredibly fun. I was part of the Sidewalk Chalk Artist Guild, and it was a kind of ragtag. I mean, almost imagine like artist pirates is the best way I could describe it. People totally committed to the busker lifestyle, you know, big earrings and tattoos and flamboyant clothing. And we would paint all day. And then we'd get a bottle of wine from the Vino Sfuso, which is the wine on tap stores that they have in Italy. And then we'd celebrate drinking on the street in front of our drawings all night long. And it was just a wild, wonderful, very educational time. And I was also in school at that time studying traditional oil painting kind of simultaneously. So I was really straddling these two worlds of folk art for the people. Most of my colleagues in the guild were self-taught artists, really living a kind of fringe lifestyle. And at the same time in school, I was studying a very highbrow traditional craft. A lot of my peers were, you know, very wealthy foreign students from around the world. And so I was trying to kind of find my place between these two extremes. And at sometimes that was really challenging, but I felt like it really fleshed me out into a kind of holistic artist that could really appreciate art's role in society in a lot of different facets.
I'm dying to ask you what happens as you're making art with the interaction with the audience, and how does that actually change and shift with being in a public space making art and having this constant interaction with you, and how does that work? And I imagine it's quite addictive, so I'm fascinated to hear more about it.
You know, it was a great feedback loop because I immediately learned what works and what doesn't, what grabs people's eyes and what is kind of boring. You get this immediate reaction, right? And so some of the things that changed through doing this process were I learned that you always do the eyes first. As soon as you have two big eyes on the pavement, even if there's no face, but if there's two big eyes looking out at the viewer, and if those eyes have those little glints in them, that little white dot that makes it look shiny, people start giving you money and they start losing their mind. There's something so primal about eye contact and gaze. It's like a, you know, that thing inside of us when we're babies that connects to faces and eyes. You know, we have that our whole life. So people immediately start to connect to your work. And when I was busking, it was my job. So I was interested in, you know, the craft of it, but I was also trying to pay my bills as a student and my rent and my tuition. And so I learned very quickly how to connect with people, you know, both to get their money, but also just to create something that would be appreciated. So eyes looking out at the audience was a big one. And then once you have that, you know, like color, just contrasting textures, playing with all these tools that the painter has, I became very, you know, adept at understanding what was going to get a reaction. And I continue to use that in my practice now, even though I'm not creating for tips and I have a lot more leeway in my commissions now. I'm not, you know, strictly doing things on chalk or trying to work against the clock in a day. But I use a lot of those experiences to inform my compositions and my work today.
I know it's kind of a sort of a lame question, but like how big were these pieces that you were doing? Because I'm like, I think there's a lot of skill in being able to like, you know, work around, but also, you know, figure out where you're going to put this thing. And then you have to move quickly because there's people and it's just such an interesting process to me. And so, yeah, tell me more about that.
Sure. So in the city of Florence, where I was living and working, the art form is actually a historic art form that dates back to the Renaissance, and they call it Madonnaro art. And that means someone who paints the Madonnas. And traditionally, the artists would paint exclusively pictures of the Madonna for Catholic holy days. And so because it's this traditional art form, the city actually has in the main square 10-foot by 10-foot frames embedded in the pavement. They're brass squares, just the empty frame, like flat on the ground. And then inside the frame are these incredibly smooth slate cobblestones, very large ones so that you don't have a lot of lines in your drawing. And there's three of them, at least there were three of them when I was living there. And you would rent from the city commune, you'd rent the ability to use one of those squares, and you'd have to be part of the guild to do that. And the reason they organized it this way was so that the streets weren't just completely blocked and filled with artists working everywhere, but also to honor this craft and kind of elevate it as something uniquely Italian, uniquely Florentine. So we were limited to that 10-foot by 10-foot size. And that is about what I can and what most artists can comfortably create in a day. That's usually a very long day. I would wake up about 8, you know, head to the street, get there by 9, and work almost continuously into the evening, you know, when the street lamps would come on. And as I said, you know, in the evening time, we'd kind of ease up a bit. There'd be some celebration. We'd get some wine and food and kind of, you know, be celebrating having mostly completed. But I would sometimes be putting touches on my drawings all the way up until the street cleaners came at midnight. And it is just chalk pastel. And so it would wash off. And actually, part of our agreement as the artists renting these spaces was that we were responsible for washing our drawings off at the end of the day. So I would bring a little street cleaning broom, some laundry detergent, and there was a old Florentine fountain pump in a few paces away. And so I'd fill up my little bucket and with the soapy water and just dump it all over my hard work and scrub it off and go home. And there was something really beautiful and cathartic about that too. And people used to say, you know, oh, how can you wash it off? It must be so sad. But it wasn't at all. Like the first time maybe was a little hard, but then after that, I just loved that process. It was just like create and release over and over again.
It's ephemeral, isn't it? It's got this really short, mm-hmm. magical moment, and then it goes. I could see washing it away as also being cathartic and actually releasing you to make more. I notice that I often get so caught up on the finished product that you forget about enjoying the process. Well, particularly when I was younger at it, but and so many people do get hooked on that finished thing. But if you know it's not going to last, then you can actually just be in the moment of enjoying making it. And there's quite a lovely release in that. You know, I'd imagine you'd be more in flow and very much in the moment.
Absolutely. Well, and as you said too, in a certain phase in your life, I think it's very important as an artist to just make a lot of art and not be so attached to the end product. And that was certainly that time for me. I was, you know, making a big mural every week in addition to my studies at school, in addition to whatever art I was doing personally in my sketchbooks. And you know, that's how I really learned as an artist, was to just make and make and make and make and kind of not try to hold on to what I made, but just keep looking ahead to the next thing. And, you know, that's something I always tell my students and when they're starting out is, you know, maybe paint 100 paintings before you worry about how good they are. Just keep painting.
I think there's also something really beautiful. Like I was just thinking, you know, you have this more formal education and then this other really loose, like self-created education. And I think doing this other part where you're putting your work on display every day, I think it helps you just get used to people seeing your work, like seeing they're watching what you do. They're, you know, you get to decide if there's mistakes or not. And you are out on public display. And I think that creates a lot of resiliency for the future. And so I think both of these like just sound like they work really well in tandem. You could do them both at the same time, but for sure having these two different kinds of education just create the really balanced artist. And I really love that. By the way, I've been to Florence and I must not have paid attention because I did not see any of that. And that's really sad.
Well, there's one street when it happens and only one street. So if you hadn't walked down that street, you would have missed it. If anyone's going to Florence and wants to know, it's the street that leads from the Ponte Vecchio to the Duomo.
How could I not have gone on that street? I don't know. I don't know. We were only there one night, so spent more time other places. Next time I will go. This doesn't happen every day though, right? Like is someone there every single day?
In the nice weather, yeah, there usually is someone every day.
Sad that I didn't see that. You know,
reason to go back.
Yeah, exactly. I think, Len, were you going to say something?
No.
Oh.
I thought you were talking and leading on to a question.
Well, I was just thinking that maybe this is a great time to talk about like life balance because, you know, when you're working, I was thinking when you're working all day, it's so physical, right? And I think a lot of us do this. We have different parts of our lives that, you know, maybe that we do different things. Maybe we have a full-time job and we're trying to have art and we have kids or, and we have this or, and we have that. And for sure, that probably was also a great lesson for you on how to balance these things. You know, yes, you're immersed in art, which is what some people like really dream of. But it's kind of a balancing act. And so I'm wondering how that worked for you then and how it works for you now.
It's a great question. Well, I was 20 at the time. So I had a lot more capacity to squat all day and crawl around on the hard pavement. And my body was very sore after every day, but could do it. And I didn't think very far ahead about that. But about, you know, 5, 6, 7 years into doing that, because I did continue to work as a pavement artist, even after returning to the US, I realized that this was not something I could do for the rest of my life, or it wasn't something that was I could expand into a really full-time sustaining career, because it is so hard on my body. And so that led me to shift into doing more murals and commission work. And I really built a successful career in the Seattle area as a muralist. And interestingly, now I'm wanting to become a mother. I don't currently have a child, but that is the next phase of life that me and my husband are wanting to step into. And so again, I'm realizing that I won't be able to paint murals. That won't, my career path will not be able to follow me into this next phase, because murals, you have to be on scaffolding long hours. Again, you're often working against the clock. You know, you have a deadline when you have to have everything done by, or you're working to finish before the rain comes at the end of the week, all these considerations. And that's not conducive to being a good mother to a child that needs you, or, you know, is certainly not being pregnant or breastfeeding or any of those things. So again, I'm having to kind of shift. And all of these shifts were not things that I really anticipated until they came. And then when they came, there was a sense of kind of having the rug pulled out, like, oh crap, I've got to make a shift, you know, I've got to pivot, because it, and I wasn't planning on that, but I've learned to just trust that process, because so far it's worked out for me. And I, a long time ago, let go of what I thought my career was going to look like as an artist. Like I said, I thought I was going to be a portrait artist, and that decision to become a portrait artist led me to do many other wonderful things that were not portrait art. So I kind of trust the scariness of the uncertainty at this point, but always am guided, I guess, by that seeking of balance and ultimately seeking of what's going to be healthy for your body. Because if you don't have your body health, what do you have? You know, you can't do any of it.
I literally just sent an email to my people this week. If you're on my email list, then you got it. But it was about like our physical health. Like that is actually the baseline number one to being able to have the energy that we want to do what we want, to create what we want. And, you know, looking after that is super important. You know, I mean, you know, we all have, you know, I've had 4 babies, and that's such an interesting process of, you know, watching your body, you know, and Len has 1 baby and he's an adult, and all mine are adults, and you didn't have the baby, Len, but for sure, you know, there's a lot of physicality involved in what we do, because most of us are producing something physical, so you have to use your body for it. And it is such an interesting, it is interesting to practice listening to your body, because none of us are the same. So it's an interesting practice to listen to your body and tune in to know exactly what you need to do when, like when you need to back off, when you need to make a shift, when you can really push yourself, you know. And as Len knows we're nature photographers. And so, you know, and Len told you before we got on here, he does a lot of bushwalking, right? And so we're, you know, we're always out in nature doing the things, and we need our energy for that. So Len, what's been your experience with this, you know, balancing your energy and finding life balance?
I remember wanting to give up my career to pursue art. And it was this huge thing where I felt like my career was overtaking me and that I had no time or energy to do my art. And it was this huge dream to pack it all in. And I tried that. I actually tried and I failed. And I didn't survive making money out of my art. And it was really fascinating because that was a life lesson. And this is something that happened when I was 30. But years and years later, I actually combined the two together. And suddenly, and when I say my career, and that my career is an educator. So when I actually brought making art and teaching art to one, my whole life just absolutely changed. And the energy just totally shifted when I brought them all into the one thing. And that was my pivot moment. Rather than seeing it as one or the other, bringing all of the elements of things that I was doing together. And I did it almost accidentally. It wasn't a conscious decision. And I really loved what you were talking about, how you pivot on things. Life throws us these particular events and we end up pivoting. And I really feel and believe that we end up somewhere better when we're forced to do things. And it just happened this week to me. I had this major moment where everything fell apart. I was working on a website and e-learning, and I just hit a wall and I threw it all in the air and started again somewhere else. And I was like, oh my God, this is an epiphany moment. And I ended up, I'm actually in a better space on what I'm working at than the wall that I hit. And I thought I was going pretty good, and it sort of threw me around. And I'm elaborating on this because it's an art skill, isn't it? Letting go of the final outcome and following the artwork as you're producing it throughout the day or with a mural, and that we actually learn to let go of that focused, really focused final direction. I was going to ask you about that. Is that something that you think you learnt from your art and this ability to pivot and to let go of having an imaginary future, just like an imaginary artwork?
I hadn't actually made the connection between the artistic process. So I love that you said that. But when you did speak on that, I immediately thought of a painting I'm working on now where in the process of working on it, I've discovered things that I'm not very good at or things that I thought were going to go one direction. And then as I'm painting, they don't look how I imagined they would look on the canvas. And that's exactly a metaphor for the parallel of what we're talking about. You know, when you head out in a direction in life and then maybe you realize, oh, it's not actually as fun as I thought, or I don't actually have the skills to do this right now the way I thought I did, or, you know, just it's not working out the way I thought. So pushing through that, whether it's getting the skills to go forward, going in a different direction, scrapping the whole thing altogether, I mean, that is the creative process. And it's a muscle, I think, that we learn in many ways through our life. We learn through small things like working on a painting or, you know, creating a song and pushing through those blocks. And we also learn through overcoming big challenges in life that maybe seemingly have nothing to do with our creative practice. But tying it back to education, this is one of the reasons I passionately wish we had more art education in school, because it's not that everyone needs to be an excellent potter or weaver, but everybody needs to be able to develop these creative muscles that apply to all these things in our lives.
I'm totally. I want to know what those creative muscles are. Like, what do we learn from being to learn to be an artist or not, or learning to make art? What is it that, what are those muscles? What are the ones that we learn that are for you that are so special?
Well, I'm thinking about a teacher who I had that said, well, there's a couple things that just stick out. One is when you think it's done, that's when the work begins. So that ability to push yourself past what you know and what is comfortable, and to do that kind of within yourself without necessarily having someone guiding you, that ability to find your own edge and push into it, that is such a life skill in so many ways. And that's exactly kind of what we're talking about with the creative process. When you are working on a project and you get into that place where you're like, well, what will happen if I try this? I've never done that before. Like, what happens if I combine these inks, you know? And just, it's like a safe risk-taking that your nervous system can handle, that feels fun, that is exciting, even if it's just happening on the paper or behind your camera, but it's practicing that exploration, that curiosity. And then the other thing I'm immediately remembering from a great mentor was the advice that I should seek 100 rejections a year. And that's something I've actually lived by, is just put myself out there and look at rejection as success, even when it happens, because I've put myself out there. And that is the whole point. And then, of course, inevitably, if you're putting yourself out there enough, you do get opportunities opening up for you. But, you know, that is a great kind of career advice piece that has served me in sort of everything. You know, it applies to dating. It applies to, you know, all sorts of job interviews and applying for a house or an apartment, you know, whatever, just the courage to go for it.
I love that. So I'm like, oh, I know what that is. So like, there's this resilience muscle that you build by getting all of the rejections, which I think is really amazing, because so often we get one rejection or two and we make it mean so much. And, I think that's why, you know, some of us as artists, like, we just quit because it's too difficult. We make it mean that something's terrible about not just us, but our art, and where it's so personal to us, you know? And so by doing that, you can build up that resilience and be able to just keep on going. Oh, doesn't matter. I'm going to submit it. It's almost like I submit it, or I ask for the thing, or I apply to the thing, and then you've already moved on. Because whether or not you get the no or the yes, like, yes is going to be great, but no, it doesn't even matter anymore. You have success by just showing up and doing the application. And then the other one is like, I was thinking for my own self, is decreasing frustration. And I get frustrated so easily, especially when I'm like, I can't figure this out. I don't know what, you know, and I used to be in that space. Like, I don't know how to do this. You know what I mean? Especially when your skills don't yet match your vision, that can be really frustrating. And if you're able to just release frustration, like, that's not really a thing here. What other choices do I have here in this moment? Oh, I can be excited to discover more about what's in me versus like being frustrated. And so that's where I lean into. I feel so much better when I totally ditch frustration. I've been really eliminating it so much out of my life, and I feel better. Like, I'm more able to do better work because of it. And I really like that a lot.
Mm. So you're working on changing your reaction to something.
Yeah.
That's what frustration is, isn't it?
Well, yes, it's an yeah.
It's a reaction.
Yeah. And for me, frustration comes because I'm thinking thoughts that cause me frustration. I called my friend once. This has nothing to do with art, but also everything we learn in life can be applied to art. So, I don't believe that we create in a bubble. I called my friend once. I'm like, I am so frustrated with my husband, but I also know that it's not about him and anything he did. It's purely about me and what I'm thinking. And so when I can pinpoint that and I can say, you know what, he didn't do, there's nothing about him. Like, there's nothing wrong there. It's all me. I just didn't like it. And that's not a problem either. So once I see that, I can just totally change how I'm looking at it. I can change what I think. I don't have to be in that space. So I think there's a lot of nuance in that, you know, to be able to, there's a muscle building, you know, there's practice involved with that, but it's absolutely possible to change over time your reactions to things and actually look forward. You could make it a space where you look forward to the challenge because of what you end up learning and how you end up growing. And then then all of a sudden it shifts from you're not frustrated anymore, because that will stop you every time. So you're not frustrated anymore. You're really growing and learning, and you even actually grow more exponentially because you're looking forward to it. You put those challenges, you know, in place for yourself. I think it's really amazing to be in that space.
It sounds like you're good at catching yourself and like noticing what is happening inside. And then I'm curious, how do you make that shift? Are you stepping away and taking a break, or do you have something you redirect your attention on? And, you know, how, like, if, for example, if you were working on a creative project and you got really frustrated, you know, what would you actually do to shift that?
So because I've been focusing on frustration, I know exactly how it feels in my body, because all of our emotions are like, they're physical sensations. And so when I feel that, I know it's a reminder to me that, oh, that's just something I've experienced before at this point. And I can step back, and let me pause here and say, this is absolutely a practiced skill, because it used to be that I was experiencing the frustration and then all the other things that went along with it. And I'm like, why did I have that outcome? Why did I give up on that? Why did I do such and such? And then I could go backward and go, okay, it's because I was feeling frustration. Okay, why am I feeling frustration? It's because of, you know, I'm thinking that this is too hard, or I can't do it, or whatever it is, right? And so over time, well, as I can learn to literally step back and see, this is the skill to step. It's a mindfulness practice. When you are mindful, when you're practicing mindfulness, you can literally see what you're thinking. It's all about seeing what's going on in your brain from like an objective perspective. And so I've trained myself to do this. Doesn't happen all the time. I get frustrated and, you know, I'm not a robot, but as I have practiced it, I can now feel the frustration and I go, oh, I see exactly what's happening here. I know where this goes. This doesn't end well. And so I can literally take a step backwards and go, okay, How do I now want to look at this, right? So then I have these reminders. And sometimes if I'm feeling really frustrated, I do, Gabrielle, have to step away and take a walk. Like Len and I have talked a lot about taking walks because it does so much for you. And so, you know, Len's laughing. Yeah, because walks are amazing. And so being able to just step away for a bit, cool down my nervous system and all the frustration, and then come back with a fresh mind, and then I can do all those things that I talked about. Yeah, you're right. It's those two things in tandem, but it's just a practice that you learn over time, but it can be done. It's amazing work.
I just was thinking while you're talking how I'm one of those artists that has 15 different projects going at once. And I didn't really put it together until now, but I think one of the benefits of working that way is the ability, when you get frustrated on one, to jump to another. And there's been times when I've been actually annoyed with myself, like, oh, why can't I just work on one thing until it's done? But I'm kind of seeing now, this is one of the flip side values of that, is the ability to take that energetic break and do something else.
Oh, it's very good to do that. I, you know, our brains are so powerful that they can work on 15 things at once. In the background, not in the consciousness, like we focus on one at a time, but in the background, that extra space allows you to solve the problems and to figure out what it is. I do that too, and suddenly I have the answer that I could be frustrated at not being able to find the answer, but that space where I'm doing something else, the answer comes, and the artwork always benefits from that time of rest and sitting there and maturation. Like it improves with age in that sort of sense in my head. Like it's growing and changing and morphing in there. And I walk away when, like, that's what I did last week. I just went, right, turn off of the computer, and I went out for the rest of the day. And by the next morning, even by that night, I was researching a new answer and working on the way around it, instead of wallowing in that moment of frustration.
It really is important to put these kind of protocols in place for ourselves, because what we really want is we want, however it works, to, we want our work to move forward. And so, you know, like we just had three different ways to do this, which I think is like really beautiful, you know, to, and I'm sure there's more, you know, depending on people and individuals, you know. And I think it is important to put these kind of things in place so you know what your go-to is when you're feeling a certain way, so that you can keep the work moving forward. Okay, I have a question. You're like working on 15 things at a time. I like to work on multiples. Len likes to work on multiples. I think some people find it hard to, you know, like I've talked with artists that have a hard time focusing on multiple projects, partly because they don't trust themselves to finish them if they start it, especially if they're working on multiples. How do you manage, like, balance that and manage that?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, part of how I manage it is having many, many things that don't get finished. And I think that's okay. I think it's part of the process. You know, I have projects that I've outgrown that I started years ago and they were really engaging at the time, and I worked on them part-time and they're no longer relevant, and they were part of my journey, but they haven't made it into my final portfolio. And there's a sadness in that, but it's not a failure. It's part of the process. So I think being okay with that's important. And then there, the other side of that, the other side of the coin is having commitments to yourself when it is something that is relevant. You know, if it is still feeling relevant year after year, you gotta do it. And so, you know, example of that for me right now is I several months ago realized that it had been a long time since I had done traditional oil painting, and because I'm a muralist, but I love traditional oil painting. I love the slow, methodical process of rendering something really realistically. But it's not a skill that I use very often in my professional work. And so it was something I felt like was getting rusty. So right now I'm trying to paint for an hour a day, just for me. And I have a painting, which is behind me right now, that I'm chipping away at laboriously for months. And I don't know when this is ever going to get finished. And I don't know if I'll still like it when I get finished. But that particular piece is one of those pieces that it's about the process of practicing my skill and keeping my craft fresh, almost like a musician would, you know, you practice scales to keep yourself fresh. There's an element of that as an artist. And yeah, and it doesn't actually matter so much if everything gets finished that way.
By the way, as because I've been following you on Instagram, so if you want to see her working on the painting, you can go follow her on Instagram. We'll put all the links in the episode notes, but for sure. Right. Cause you've been posting about this too. And I've been watching it like come alive and anyway, it's really beautiful. I was wondering if that was behind you, what you were working on. Okay. So Len, sorry, interruption, but you know,
I was fascinated to hear you talking about the professional side and this personal practice that you're playing with. And, you know, have you had to balance between the two, or do they merge into one whole art practice and it's just one whole thing going, or do you separate them, or do you have to spend time trying to find a balance? Can you elaborate on that? Because that really tweaked something for me.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been an angsty journey, I would say, honestly, that I wish that my creative practice and my money-making practice were more completely the same thing. But in my life, they have gone in and out of being close together. So there's times when the money-making projects I'm working on, while they are art-making, they have not fed me creatively. And then there's times when they have. But it's been an undulation and a kind of an interweaving for my life that has at times felt very painful when it's not congruent. So that's something that I'm constantly trying to balance. And I think it's very rare that artists are able to 100% of the time be in their zone of art making genius and make money exclusively from that. And that's just one of the sad realities of our society. I think it's easier than it's ever been to make money as an artist. And we have all these different ways to monetize our craft that we didn't have available to us before. So this isn't like a sad situation. It's not a sob story. But the truth is that, you know, that kind of dream where you're painting in your studio all day long, somebody else handles all your marketing and your sales and packing all your merchandise and prints for you. I mean, that's a very rare reality, and it's not my reality right now, though I would love it to be someday, and maybe I'll get there. I'm very hopeful I can get there, but it's not currently my reality. And so I've had to just accept that, you know, the conversation about frustration plays in here. At times that's been really frustrating, and at times, you know, Len, you were talking about either just career choices and trying to commit to your art. There's been times when I wanted to give up being an artist and just get a job that paid my bills and then keep art exclusively something for me. But, you know, I in feeling into that and exploring that, I realized that really wasn't my path. And I have been able to understand that, you know, art making really is my zone of genius. And while my studio practice may not be the thing that financially sustains me, I can bring that zone of genius into a lot of other areas that do. So when I do like mural commissions, for example, you know, maybe I'm designing something for a high school and I have a very set list of parameters that are given to me to follow for the mural. And that can feel creatively constricting. However, within that, I am bringing my creative zone of genius, weaving it into this work as much as possible. And that ultimately is more fulfilling to me than if I was doing something that was purely just for the money. So it is a balance. But what has made that balance feel better for me, I'm going to bring it back to the hour of day of painting, has been a game changer. You know, if I'm doing that, if I'm doing my art and just connecting to it a little bit every day, I don't really mind if I'm doing a design commission that has nothing to do with it. And again, sometimes those commission projects, they do feel like the musician practicing scales. You know, it's maybe not my magnum opus, but I'm drawing, I'm working with color and composition, I'm practicing my skill all the same.
As a musician, I think there's also a lot of beauty in practicing scales. Like, I find them challenging, and I think, you know, even if you are doing something that's maybe not your total passion, but you're still, it's still a part of the practice, I still think that there's beauty in it. It's so interesting that I think as artists, we are all wanting personal time for creating. I haven't talked to anyone that's like, I have all the time I want to for personal creating. Very, very rarely, like you said. And that includes myself because, you know, while I love what I do, you know, even, you know, doing this podcast takes my time. I do the editing, you know, and, you know, I'm coaching. And so, you know, I'm having to balance my time. Okay, where do I want to put my own personal creative work here? I mean, I have something that I'm really wanting to work on. And I was like, oh my gosh, I didn't even put that on my schedule for this week. So it's going to take me more brain power than just an hour a day or 30 minutes a day or whatever. I think I do better when I can go like 4 days with nothing and then do it for 3 hours. So it's just important to know how we work but also put it on your calendar. So I have a question about this. This is so minutia, but do you have the time scheduled when you do it, when you paint?
I love that question because actually I do not currently, but I'm feeling like it's something I should start doing because what I'm noticing is that if I don't schedule it, then sometimes the rest of my day, like maybe I'll put it off and the rest of my day starts to feel compressed and cramped and it can cause stress. And I've been thinking a lot about in my life, just I'm working with my life coach and we're talking about the concept of fun and how that's actually one of my core values. Same. The whole reason I pursued an art career and being self-employed is because I wanted to do what was most fun, right? So if I'm, forcing myself to paint every day and it's stressing me out, or I'm doing it in a way that is causing disorder in the rest of my life, then it stops being fun and it starts being stressful, and that's stupid. So I think actually really diligent scheduling can be a tool to create ease and space, and that's kind of my, one of my personal goals for the next couple of months is to be a little more on top of things for the sake of, creating that space and ease in my life.
I love that you said ease, because that is actually the word that came to me at the beginning of this year. So last year, my word was expand. Mm-hmm. I did a lot of expanding, but this year it's ease. And so I'm literally like, the reason why I haven't had a lot of time to do my personal, a lot of personal art is because I'm putting some things in place in my house. Like, I'm going through my whole house. This is a thing too, taking care of other things in our lives so that the rest of it kind of feels easy and fun when we do get to it. Like, I went through my whole kitchen. I cleaned out the pantry. I cleaned out the spices. I wiped everything down. Now when I open up the cabinets, I'm like, the only things that are here are exactly what I need. Right. So I'm doing that in all of the different rooms in my house. And I know it's going to take months because I also have travel and I also have things I'm doing, but I want that so much this year. And there's other things I'm doing too. Like, how can I do this with ease? This is the question that I'm asking myself. And the idea of fun also resonates with me because whenever I think of a new idea, it always starts with, wouldn't it be fun if I started a podcast with Len? Wouldn't it be fun if we had a conversation with Gabrielle? And so that's how really beautiful things get made for me in my world, is because I'm like, wouldn't it be fun if? And so I love those two things because it makes life feel playful and easy. I want more of that always.
Absolutely.
I think I'm very lucky that my work actually forces my creativity. Mm-hmm. And it actually makes me get into that space, and I get to create while I'm working. And in many times it drives my creativity in terms of making art. I think combining them so that they were all together actually was incredibly freeing, and it provides the motivation, the finances, and the space to keep going. And yet I still have my own personal projects, but I don't think of them as being off by themselves. I think of them just being as part of, as you said, practicing your scales, as little moments of escapism, and they're very opportunistically based. So someone comes along to be photographed or to make art with, and I make the space to work with them. And then when there's no one there, I concentrate on my other stuff, which is much more work. So it's a fascinating balance, isn't it, to get rid of that frustration, like, I'm not making enough of it, and then to go down that path of being so stuck in the work and making financial things and losing yourself in that and feeling like you don't have your being in touch with your creativity and making those things. And it sounds like you've found a really lovely way of working that keeps changing as you grow and life circumstances keeps changing for you.
Well, it's got to keep changing, as we change. That's part of having your work be an expression of your soul, right? It's a part of you, and we're always changing. I had the realization recently too that I'm not going to finish or create all the creative ideas that are in my head before I die. There's just no way. And that was really depressing to think about for a moment. And then it became kind of freeing because I realized, okay, well, I will do my best to get to as many of them as I can, but clearly it's not about getting them all done, because there's no way I can do that. That's not a realistic expectation to put on our lives. So it's got to be just about the process of doing them and the state of mind that I'm in when I make art. Maybe that's the most important part, is just being in that place, that creative place, as much as possible and just giving as much as I can. And I do kind of believe that, you know, there's the muses whispering down to us ideas. And when we have the ability to realize their ideas and their songs, that's great. But then if we don't do it, they're going to go find someone else to whisper to. So I, you know, I will commit to realizing as many of these ideas as I can. And then I'm also just going to trust that the ones I don't get to, somebody else will get to them. And that's going to be okay.
They absolutely will.
That's such a beautiful way of dealing with letting go of ideas, isn't it? And it's in Big Magic, she talks about ideas being out in the world and that we can't actually possibly own them, that someone else will pick them up. And, you know, when I was younger, I definitely wrestled with this idea that that idea was mine and how dare you take it from me and use it. And now I've learned to relax and let go. And I love this beautiful concept that they're just floating around, and whoever actually has the space to give them what they deserve, to bring them to fruition, is where they need to be. And as we've seen in science, they can appear simultaneously in multiple parts of the world, and that's actually a beautiful thing, not a negative, competitive sort of space that we're in. I really love that. It's a beautiful way of dealing with, hey, I can't do all my ideas. What am I going to do?
I always just say, oh my gosh, look at how many ideas I have. That's totally amazing. Now, and I have a place where I put them. It's called my someday maybe list. And sometimes I, you know, every couple of weeks I look at it. I'm like, oh, I'm not ready to do that. Or I'm not ready to do that. Or it's okay if I never do that. And ultimately, when I have space for a new one, the next one will bubble up and prioritize itself, like almost on its own. Or I'll have a couple that I feel really strongly about. And so I'll have to go, okay, what, you know, realistically, what kind of space, time and energy space do I have for this? Because I think that's how we get burnt out, is by choosing so many from our list that we feel like have to get done. And they don't, like, that we can trust that somebody else is going to do them, or that we'll get to them one day if they're still, you know, important to, you know, for us. But being able to just choose one or two at a time, or we can have 15 at a time, like you have, Gabrielle, and trusting that we'll get, you know, that we'll be able to work on them as needed, as the inspiration comes to us. This work is so interesting because it's not like 1 + 1 = 2. It's like 1 + 1 = like some sort of weird design. there's real magic involved in this, in what we do. And sometimes it's just unexplainable. And so being able to listen to really your intuition and going, okay, I want to work on that. That makes absolutely no sense, but that's what's going to happen now. And trusting that that is the thing that's going to do something incredible that I have no, you know, I don't know what. Like you were saying, you know, when you were in Florence and you were like, I don't know why I was doing these things necessarily, but it works out when we listen to that intuition. I love that part too.
I wanted to ask Gabrielle, how do you know which ones to work on next, and you know, what pulls you towards certain ones to finish?
Well, that word fun that I mentioned before is a real guiding value for me. It's, you know, sometimes it's what's going to be the most fun. And I don't think that's frivolous at all, because what I noticed is when I'm having fun doing something, I work so much better and so much faster, and I execute at a higher level of mastery. It just, everything is kind of better around the process. So if I'm trying to, you know, if my service to the world is my art, which I believe it is, I want to do that in the most efficient, masterful way as possible as a gift to the world. So if I am following the fun, I'll be better at that. So that's a definite consideration. You know, and then there's also practical considerations of, you know, what's going to further my career, what's going to, you know, maybe make money. Those things do come into play too. Another thing that, you know, I think about a lot is creating things that I would actually want in my house or in my life. You know, sometimes there's ideas that you think, oh, that's really fun, and you maybe shelve it somewhere. But then when you come back to it, you think, yeah, I could make this, but like, would I really want to own this myself, you know, or wear this garment or whatever? So that's an important filtering metric for me.
Both of those are really centered in where your soul's at, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
'Cause you mentioned that earlier on today, following what your soul's talking to you and where you should be and what you're going. And it's a very, very personal metric rather than an external one. And I really believe that's one of the keys, isn't it? Is to listen to ourselves, listen to our calling, listen to whatever it is that takes us into that flow state. And for you, you've identified the word fun. And that's when the whole world disappears, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Something I've been thinking a lot about recently is the flow state and the sort of state of art making. I've been obsessively binging the Emerald podcast. I don't know if either of you listened to that, but Joshua Schrey, he discusses in this podcast the Paleolithic brain versus the modern brain a lot. And one of the things he talks about is how for, you know, 95% of our species history, we were in this kind of hunter-gatherer state and spending a lot of time in a trance-like flow, you know, hunting, tracking, making all our things by hand, building fire with friction, all these things that take a lot of artistry and focus. And, you know, for them, the last 5 minutes of human history, this last, you know, several thousand years, several hundred thousand years, I guess, since then. Or what? What are we, 10,000 years of the agricultural revolution? 11,000? I'm terrible at this stuff. But basically a blip on our history. We've been in this modern brain. And art making is one of the things that gets us back into that Paleolithic kind of brain where we're in that trance state, that altered state. And so I've been just thinking about that a lot. And then also the concept, like kind of tying that to the ego as the artist, and particularly trying to release the ego. And that's kind of tied to releasing the need to get everything done or complete everything or, you know, be perfect at everything, and making it more about the importance of doing it and being in that state. Maybe that's the more important goal. So it's something I'm kind of playing with, and I'm not sure where that's going to lead me, but I am on this shift in my career where I'm shifting away from murals, which has been my whole livelihood, and I'm not fully sure how I'm going to do that and what's going to come next. But I'm clear that I want to be guided by these things that are really interesting to me right now, which is kind of this exploration of, like you said, flow states and just a more, I think, a more ego-free approach to art making seems like a healthy direction.
Does the ego extend out to external validation or to the audience and to that larger people, do you think, as well?
It's a good question. I mean, I would think yes, right? Like the ego wants to be liked by all the people who see it. And it can be very upsetting if people don't like it. But then I go back to that concept of service. Like if we view our art as a service and what we're offering to the world, we should be able to get to a place where we say, oh, people didn't really appreciate that. Maybe that wasn't the most helpful art for other people. And maybe that's okay. It's not actually about us, you know?
I asked that pointedly because we're going back to drawing on the sidewalks. And there's this almost, in my imagination, whether it's true or not, there's people there talking to you while you're making. And there's almost a community forming around you of what's happening. And I'm just imagining that influence on you and having to learn to balance that as, you know, years later, it's now left you in this really great place of letting go of what people think about it.
I don't know that I have let go, though. I think I actually have found a way to make more peace with creating for others. Like, if I want to just create for myself, purely for myself, I view that as kind of art therapy. And I may or may not share that with the world, but I wouldn't expect anyone to like that or it to be financially supporting me. But when I'm painting for my studio practice right now, I am painting for myself, but I'm also thinking about, why am I painting this for the world? What is the message that I'm trying to deliver? What's the state of consciousness that I want to encourage with people who see this work? And that's a very integral part of my creative inspiration right now, because, and it's part of, you know, watching the horror in the world and thinking, what can I do? And if, you know, my skill set is art, like, how can my art somehow help this, however indirectly? So I'm always weaving in what I know about what people like. But I maybe am not so attached to it. If I get it wrong, I don't take it as personally.
It's like a collective therapy, isn't it? Almost in that way of thinking, that it's for the community and I'm part of that process, and how it fits with them. It's for everyone's therapy.
I was just thinking, if people are talking to you while you're making art, and maybe there's like adjustments that you make while they're talking to you, that they are part of the work. Like, somehow, you know, if you're thinking about other people and while you're in the process, right, in the practice of making, they are part of the process. Like, they are in the art. And that to me is also really interesting too, because then it takes you from a space, if that's partly the case or sometimes the case, then it takes you from a space of like, I'm solely creating and seeing what you think, to being like, this is a community thing. Like, you are already part of it. And so it doesn't matter now what you say, because you are already, you were already part of it as I was doing it. And whether or not people feel that, like, people know that there is some sort of strands of energy that people do feel like when they, I think when they look at it, like if they were part of it, and, you know, maybe this is a world thing too. So I find a lot of these concepts. So like they art get so woven together between you. That's why I say, we don't create in a bubble, because everybody is part of it, right? And you're not ever just solely by yourself. Well, okay, you are actually on an island, but like, you live on an island, but you're not creating like, like, literally you're on an island, but figuratively you're not creating on an island. And I think that's part of the beauty and the humanity of art, is that we can include other people while we're doing it.
Absolutely. And one of the most common reactions when I was creating in the public eye is just, first a wow, and then someone telling me about their experience of creating art. Oh, I love what you're doing. I used to make art too. Or one time I painted a picture of the Madonna also, or maybe even, you know, my sister is an artist. And so most of the time people are just feeling inspiration and energy by watching artists. And yeah, sometimes people would say, oh, that hand looks a little weird. But I mean, I can't even remember specifically that happening. It happened so infrequently. Most of the time people are just very appreciative to have the creative act brought into their life and be able to be in communion and conversation with an artist. And that was almost the greater gift than the art itself, or however good the painting was.
it's so beautiful that art provides a conversation, a really rich conversation for the whole community to question, to discuss, or to bring out all these little things that I particularly love that aspect of art, and I think that that's you know, it's one of the reasons why we actually need arts to be better funded and to be part of the community, because it serves this incredible therapeutic and conversation starter that is so necessary in the world, just as music is, and all of the arts, not just one, like a visual art, but performance art, dance, the whole spectrum. It ties us all together so beautifully, and serves this incredibly beautiful function in the world, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And it's a spot of connection that incorporates the subconscious too. You were talking about the subconscious earlier, Len. You know, we can all look at a piece of art together and kind of share these nonlinear perspectives or depths of ourselves that we might not be able to bring out openly in just a normal conversation or you know, a debate about geopolitical issues, which are much more rational. You know, the art is a kind of more organic point of connection, more mysterious point of connection.
One of the biggest thing I learned when I was studying art therapy was you can't tell someone what an artwork means to them or means to anyone else. And that I had to really go through that experience of learning that, to let go of meaning in artwork, because so many people are, you know, they're driven by this question, particularly when they're teaching, what are you trying to say? Or, and oh, that doesn't say that to me. And that actually, it's a furphy. It catches us up and goes us off in a totally different direction. And it's not to say that being clear as to what we're trying to do with our art isn't important, because I really believe that is very, very important. But the how it interacts with other people and what it, the conversations it starts, and then the conversations with between two people standing over an artwork and talking about it are just absolutely incredible and mind-blowingly special. Like, that's one of my favorite activities in my off time, is to go to an art gallery with someone just to talk about the art, not just to go and see it, because I can do that by myself quite easily, but to go with someone who's willing to have that conversation and open up their own reactions and their ideas and their triggers and whatever's going on, and being a part of that, and it sort of opens me up in that same process. And you come away from an artwork having had that conversation as a wiser person, and having a bit more understanding for other people in the world. And it's just such a beautiful process.
One of my favorite things to do lately is to go to these exhibition openings where there's like multiple artists, you know, in a show. And I go by myself. I don't even bring my husband because then there's nobody, like, that's my safety. And it makes me talk. Well, I mean, I want to, but you know, I'm always trying to find the artist and say, tell me about this. And they almost always say, thank you so much for letting me talk about this, because people will just come up and go, oh, this is really nice. Oh, I like this. And then they leave. And having that space to be able to really discuss, and, you know, I'll ask them questions, and, you know, it doesn't take long, but it's that we're looking at your art and you're telling me about it. And I'm asking, it's like this beautiful, almost like three-way conversation that we're having. And I think that's all, like, an extension too. That's another part of, you know, besides just going with someone else that's not the artist. And I think that's really beautiful, is to have the conversation, which is why this is really great, because yeah, we're not looking at art, but we're definitely talking about, you know, all of it and the process, and, you know, what we, you know, all about what we each create and how we do it and why we do it. And that's just really beautiful. So do you guys feel like, I feel like we're done. So what's funny is I always feel like there's some point in the conversation where it just goes intuitively. It's like, this has come full circle and we're finished. So I think we all feel that.
Yeah, I feel that too.
Isn't that interesting?
Is there something you'd like to add at the end, Gabrielle?
Yes.
Yeah, I would just end by saying that if you're wanting to pursue a creative path, it is really helpful to find mentorship. And we talked a little bit about teaching, and mentorship can look a lot of different ways, but listening to these podcasts is one thing, you know, going to art galleries and studying the actual works of the masters is another, but you don't have to find your way on your own completely. I mean, you always have to find your way on your own a little bit. That's part of being an artist, but you're also part of the lineage of artists that come before you. You know, I think artists are the ancestors of other artists, you know, so you can learn from them, and then you can learn from the other people in your field. And that's been a beautiful part of my career, has been the leg up and the tips I've received from others. So if I would just put out there that I do have a small group mentorship, I open up once a year. It's best for other painters who are interested in navigating the professional side of things, people who already have a creative practice, and I work with them to develop their professional side, to really honor their true gifts and build a career that is in alignment with their true gifts. So people can find me online if they're interested in that, or if they just want to follow my journey and watch me slowly chip away at a painting an hour a day, they can follow that too.
Does it have a name yet, your work?
No, it does not. I'll wait till the end to figure that out.
All right. Well, because sometimes we do name it while we do it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Really beautiful. So we'll put all of the links to connect with Gabrielle in the episode description. So you don't have to remember anything. You just go in the episode description and click right there, and you'll be able to find her on all the socials and her website and all the things. So thank you so much for being here with us. This was really lovely. I enjoyed it.
Me too. I could have kept talking to you for hours, but maybe we'll do it again sometime. And thank you so much for having me.
And thank you so much for me. And I really appreciated learning from you in that conversation, and gaining an insight in a whole world that I'd really had no idea and thought about before. But now you talk about it, it's like, oh, okay. It's like it's another form of street busking, and it's a community, and I've got friends in the circus community, and it drew me parallels to their lives and what they do. And I was like, oh, okay. And anyway, so I'm very, very thankful for that, Gabrielle, and I wish you well. And thank you for joining us today.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. It's time to say goodbye.
Okay. Well, bye, you guys. That was so fun.
Yes, it's a fun.
Fun.
All right. Bye, y'all.
Hi.
Hi, everyone. Well, wasn't that fun? As we close another episode of A Creative Affair, would you click on your podcast player and leave us a 5-star review and share with another passionate creative like yourself? Thanks. To find out more about our creative work and mentoring, visit Len at lenschool.com or me, Bree, at creativemindscoach.com. Oh,